Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Ian Smith, Companies Editor. How are you doing, Ian?
Not too bad, John. How are you doing? It's been a very busy week for results. A bit unforeseen, bit of a wave of results came through March year end.
Maybe they're trying to get them in early before they can all have a proper summer, which means we will be able to too, which would be amazing.
That would be great.
And making her debut on the podcast, Megan Boxall. How are you, Megan?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Well, good to have you on.
Thank you.
It's all very fun and relaxed on this this podcast, so get in the spirit of things.
Okay.
Let's kick off. 7 days. I mean, Bradley's not here today. Bradley usually talks us through 7 days, but there's a couple of things on here that we've picked out. Let's start with one that we've just been talking about off air. The flotation of a posh clothing company
called Jules.
Or Jules.
What do you think, Megan?
We've just been discussing how you pronounce this because, you know, I'm not posh and I don't have a clue. Well, how do you pronounce this?
Well, I think it's Jules.
Jules?
Yeah.
I think it's like Jules.
Jules. Yeah, like Jules. Hotel chocolate. Which gets a mention as well. Anyway, this is kind of continuing the trend, having mentioned Hotel Chocolat, of these kind of upmarket-ish sort of consumer-focused flotations. What's the reception this one's getting? Likely to get. We know what's happening. We know it's floating, but yeah, what's the view?
It's a slightly weaker time on the high street than they would have wanted. And we've seen some of the retailers reporting kind of weaker footfall. So it might not be the most ideal time to float.
Hotel Chocolat, that was a very successful flotation.
Yeah, and like we discussed before, Hotel Chocolat has that whole kind of gift market, which is slightly different, isn't it? So I will admit that I didn't know anything about this company prior.
You're
to
not posh either, then.
Clearly not. Is it good?
I did know about this, believe it or not, because my children were once bought some Jewel Wellingtons when they were very young.
Was it good Wellingtons?
They look great. They look great. My kids didn't like them. So I stuck them on eBay and got loads of money from it.
Wheeler dealer.
I pray that the gift giver is not listening to this podcast. Didn't have any trouble selling it. And, I know I've seen these shops. I think there's one out in Aldborough where we occasionally go on holiday because that's how posh I am.
Where my family have a house.
Oh, do you really? I'm going to talk to you about that later. So anyway, another interesting retail IPO. I mean, while we're on the subject of retail, we might as well jump ahead, Ian, to the results section because we've had quite a few this week. But obviously the big retail result this week was Marks and Spencer.
Yeah, big result and also a big move on the day. Shares fell heavily. And
7%.
I think
so,
you're closer to 10%.
Was it closer to 10% by the end?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think we're either flat or slightly lower down the day after results. Kind of a mixture of things. It was bad in the areas that we already knew it was bad.
So clothing.
It was pretty clothing. Yeah, it was particularly bad. Comparable sales down 3%. And obviously the food did better than other areas of the food retail industry. But still, you know, you're only talking about a comparable sales increase of 0.2%. So it's not huge, but it's doing well there, obviously. But the big reception was for the new plans laid out by the new boss, Steve Rowe, who kind of set out how he's going to try and turn around the clothing division. But he did say that in the kind of short term, his measures, which include trying to get away from promotional pricing towards kind of lower quality pricing, are going to hit profits, understandably. Now, there was some negative reception, obviously, to his plans. Some people thought they weren't detailed enough. Some people felt they weren't communicated brilliantly. He was actually on the Today programme, the chief executive, talking about Mrs. M&S and how are we going to get Mrs. M&S back.
We had a little chat about this in the office, because who's Mrs. M&S? Who is Mrs. M&S?
Well, Mrs. M&S goes to Jules now.
Well, yeah. Maybe that's true.
Yeah.
And they probably buy their chocolates from Hotel Chocolat rather than M&S.
Right. But
the food's doing all right. But,
So I think some people weren't that convinced by, you know, the way it was communicated, but also that you needed more detail. But it should be said that these performance figures that have come out, you know, don't reflect the initiatives, you know, because the initiatives are now being put into place. So we're withholding judgment on those. He seems to be talking in the right areas. This is the conclusion of our retail correspondent Harriet Russell, our award-winning retail correspondent.
Oh yes, Harriet Russell. As we mentioned on last week's podcast. Yes, fantastic.
Yeah, she seems to feel that, you know, it needs some more time to kind of see how his strategy comes to fruition. But Yeah, it seems to have diagnosed the problem correctly in the results. But yeah, no, more near-term pain for shareholders is obviously not what shareholders wanted to hear. But it was hard to see how the division could be turned around very quickly. You know, what's the magic wand, really?
But then I read a criticism earlier today saying, OK, you've identified the problem, but guess what? Mark Bolland did that too. Yeah. And actually, identifying the problem is not Marks and Spencer's problem. It's fixing the problem that is the eternal problem.
Yeah, and I think that is a real challenge for them, you know. So that's why the kind of tone deafness when it came to talking about the customer, or it sounded so from the outside, didn't give people a huge amount of confidence that they were that the kind of new management team were going to be able to grab this new customer and convince them to come back into the store.
Yeah, because, I mean, Mrs. M&S, I mean, that has a kind of suggestion that they're still looking very much towards their core, I mean, let's face it, older customer, and not really thinking about the kind of future customers that they might have, like me or you, Megan, or you, Ian. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I don't buy like Marks and Spencer's these days, apart from you know, food.
Well, that's why I think it's also interesting is that, and to talk about the fact that Debenhams have got a new chief executive announced today, who actually comes from Amazon, who headed up the European kind of fashion bit of Amazon, a man called Sergio Boucher, I think is how you pronounce it, has moved to Debenhams. So that appointment kind of reflects what retailers are trying to do, which is to think more about the kind of e-commerce area. And even in M&S's results, they talked about the web-based sales rose by a quarter year on year with a record 7.4 million customers.
Yeah.
So how are they going to think more about that customer, you know, and all of us, rather than kind of a more of a traditional Mrs. M&S kind of mindset? Doesn't seem to be kind of, well, it hasn't been estimated by the market to be able to break them out of that. But like I said, it's early days. We haven't actually seen any of this come in.
No.
So a more considered approach to pricing that doesn't move around as much might get things on a more stable basis. I'm not sure.
Personally, I think pricing is not their biggest problem. I think it's product that's the problem. I don't know what everyone else thinks. But, you know, I happen to, my wife's family happen to live near one of Marks & Spencer's very largest stores in the UK. And I walked through there the other day. Clothes looks right. Looks fine, you know, and there was lots of them. And, you know, actually thought I could find something in here to buy. I think their problem is consistency. So, you know, go to a big store, yeah, it all looks good. Go to, you know, pretty much any other high street store across the country, say in Chelmsford, where I live near, and it's appalling. It's appalling. And, you know, the store estate was always a big problem for Marks & Spencer. I don't think they've cracked that by any stretch of the imagination at all. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Megan, do you have a perspective on M&S?
Well, as a shopper, M&S clothes are not something that I would touch. But although saying that, Harriet, who wrote this, was wearing a very, very nice M&S jumper last week. She was doing the brand proud. But yeah, no, M&S, doesn't seem to have got it right. It seems to be trying to attract the not big fashion. But if you're not that interested in fashion, you're not going to want to pay as much as I think M&S are charging for their clothes. I would never buy anything in M&S because it's not really that fashionable. And if I didn't want anything that fashionable, I'd go to Primark.
That's interesting.
So much cheaper.
Yeah, yeah. So price is an issue. Mm,
yeah, definitely. You can buy clothes so much cheaper in Primark or so much easier on ASOS.
Yeah, yeah, that whole fast fashion is not online. Something you associate with M&S, is
no,
it?
No, no, not
you
at all.
Go. Well, if you want any advice, Steve Rowe, give us a call. Our consultancy fee is very cheap. And we're a very well-represented demographic at the Investors Chronicle office. Okay.
And I have an M&S jumper as well.
I do as well. It shrank in the wash. I still wear it. okay, right. Let's head back to the news up front in the magazine. What else we got, Ian, that struck you in?
Well, there was a little update in terms of Ladbrokes and Gala Coral that the CMA said that they are going to have to sell off some of their shops, which is not particularly surprising.
Not
and I think people in the market thought, oh, okay, they're not being as stringent with the companies as they might have been. So, you know, maybe they've got away. So that seems to be quite a good development. So there's a little thing going on there.
Yeah, I mean, one such as a gambling. I mean, let's turn quickly to tip updates, because one of the tips we feature in the magazine this week is GVC, which had a very interesting update. They signed a nice deal with another high street bookie, Betfred.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to provide the infrastructure for Betfred's online business. And as I understand it, this is kind of infrastructure they've managed to improve or bring in via their purchase of Bwin Party. So it's kind of this case of consolidation, then adding something to your business that you can then kind of sell to a third party. And I think it's quite a long life to the contract as well. Yet it's a 10-year agreement.
Oh, but it's amazing, GBC, where it's come from to where it's, you know, seems to be now and where it could possibly be. I mean, this is they're turning this into a substantial business.
It shows that what you can do, how you can grow a business through acquisition, change a business, and then kind of add on other third-party deals as well. It's just, you can take any kind of company if you manage it right. And we've written about that in the past, haven't we? In features, the management teams that do this correctly can really transform an operation.
And if Ladbrokes has to get rid of, three or 400 shops, you've got to be thinking someone like Betfred's going to pick up a couple of them. And that's good news for GVC as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, except, I suppose, the fact that you do have the transition to online. So it's, I wonder how much the kind of store is still a currency within gambling. Obviously, that's hugely important.
No, I think it
relative
is.
To like banking branches. But still, I wonder, in terms of investment plans, if they're building their online platform, is that where they're going to look to invest?
I think stores are still important. I don't think, obviously, a lot of retail and gambling and everything is moving online. But I do think stores are important still, particularly for things like gambling, especially if you go to some of the sort of lower rent areas of the UK. Royal Mail, we've mentioned them twice in the magazine this week. We have results, which were a mixed bag, it's fair to say.
Yeah, as the case has been with Royal Mail, where they're facing competition in the area, which is the highest margin, which is the parcel business. But the other bit of related news that was good news for the stock this week was that Ofcom's decided not to introduce price controls in the access market, kind of the general letters market. So that's really good for them. So people were concerned following the collapse of Whistle, was that last year? That there was not enough, kind of like that market was not a stable enough market. But Ofcom seems to think it's the market in total is working well, especially if you look at the competition in the parcel side of things.
Yes, I mean, on the subject of Royal Mail, it's, it's not been brilliant for them, but UK Mail has been having an even more torrid time. And they've had results this week.
Yeah, they have had a couple of profit warnings and they're struggling. But it's a case of kind of lowering market expectations and slightly outperforming them. So they did actually get ahead of consensus earnings per share forecasts after kind of improving some of their processing hub in Coventry. It's been a difficult kind of environment for them, but they seem to be kind of managing it better.
And they've just appointed a guy from Parcelforce, so you'd expect a big recruit like that to really have an impact on the business there. We're still sticking with hold, I see.
Decent yield, so yeah. If you're in there for the income.
Well, I worry about high yields like that sometimes. Yeah. We had an event this week up here at the FT, which was on the subject of income, and Algie Hall gave a presentation on the subject of how you spot companies about to cut their dividends. And, unfortunately, I was on the receiving end of that because I had one of them, which is Rolls-Royce. But, he concluded actually it's very hard to spot when companies are about to cut their dividends. But high dividends, you should always be somewhat mindful that could be telling you the dividend is going to be cut. I mean, Marks & Spencer's got a pretty chunky dividend.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm an investor in Marks & Spencer, given that Steve Rowe has warned that there is pain ahead, I'd be very concerned. Been there a couple of times already.
Yeah, I mean, we had a feature, didn't we, a few months back that was looking at kind of what are the more solid dividends.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So if anyone wants to look up, a metric for how to do that, but obviously cover is the key thing, but there are other things you can look at.
Yeah, we're going to be launching something soon called Cash Clinic, which is really looking at a company's ability to generate the cash they need to fund dividends, and Algie's going to be taking what he presented at our event and really and turning that into something that we can share with all of our readers. So, yes, in these income-straitened times, I think it's quite important to know that your dividends are safe. And we're going to be really looking at that.
It's been a structural huge shift, hasn't it, with people seeking income pouring out of the bond market.
Yeah, I think one company that Algie and I discussed looking at earlier was Glaxo. And they're big dividend payer, but we do worry about them sometimes. But, Glaxo is one of the companies you feature in your piece this week, Megan.
Yes,
it is. Which is about antibiotics.
It is, yeah. Yeah, antibiotics have been in the news all week and probably will for some time as well because all the concerns that they're just not really working anymore.
Mm.
The last week a report was published. It was commissioned by the government in 2014, but it was published last week by Jim O'Neill, who actually isn't someone who's part of the industry, which I was speaking to someone who is part of the pharmaceutical industry. He's the CEO of Redx Pharma, which is a small cap pharma company. And he was saying how it's really refreshing to have someone like Jim O'Neill, who is actually an economist, doing this sort of report, because he comes up with these ideas which are really interesting, really unusual. And one of them is charging extra taxes on any large pharmaceutical company which doesn't have an antibiotics program.
I mean, we wrote a big feature about this recently, yeah. which yeah. I'm sure you read, which is written by Alex Newman.
Yeah.
Talking about this problem of antibiotic mm-hmm. resistance, and the problem was, I mean, companies just don't seem to want to invest in it because there's not enough money in it.
Yeah, there's not enough money. If you go to the doctors and you get prescribed antibiotics, they're just not expensive. You're not having to pay very much for them. So that is why big pharmaceutical companies, it's just not lucrative for them when, if they discover a good cancer drug or even respiratory and asthma treatment, the margins are massive. So it's much more worth their while from a financial perspective for them to do the work in those lucrative areas rather than the antibiotics.
So essentially Jim O'Neill is saying that, you know, a market-driven approach is not necessarily working. Mm. We need to perhaps have some kind of planned economy, as yeah. it were, within the pharma space.
Yeah, and so he suggested this levy on the pharma companies that don't invest in antibiotics, a pay-or-play scheme, and then using the funds from that to reward the companies that do come up with new antibiotics. There hasn't been a new class of antibiotic discovered since the 1980s. And considering how many are being used, I was reading in the paper this morning, actually, there was a drop last year in how many antibiotics have been prescribed last year because doctors are being told they just can't prescribe them as much anymore.
Mm.
But the drop was something like 5 million. But there's still 34 million antibiotics were prescribed last year. Now, that seems like an astonishing amount.
Sorry, so 34 million individual prescriptions.
Yeah.
So, that's half the population.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Mm.
And,
I thought the biggest problem, more of a problem even than the prescription of antibiotics to humans was the use of antibiotics in the food chain.
Yeah.
And that's what many people think is causing the problem we have now.
Yeah, and I'm not 100% sure. I don't know if anyone's 100% sure where the problem lies. I think it's probably a mixture of everything. But using antibiotics in animals farmed for meat is a problem. So when bacterial infections spread very quickly, so if a cow gets an infection, the whole herd tends to be prescribed antibiotics.
Mm.
So then they've all got these antibiotics in them, and if they are then taken to the slaughterhouse while the antibiotics are still in their system, the bacteria grow resistant to them, and then the humans eat the meat which have the antibiotic resistant bacteria in.
Well, I'm all right. I'm all right. I don't care.
If you're a vegetarian, you're fine.
I'm good. Yeah, and I don't actually take antibiotics either. I can't remember the last time I had a course of antibiotics.
That's not the problem, though. And that's what maybe is what people don't understand being the problem.
It's no, I don't. I know nothing about pharma.
It's not the fact that individuals aren't going to be able to take them. It's the bacteria have grown resistant to the antibiotics. So
evolution in action, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And evolution happens all the time. And actually, bacteria are some of the most efficient evolutionists compared to any other living thing. So whether if you've never been ill before, you've never taken them before, antibiotics that is, and then you take them because you have to, and it's not necessarily because you have an infection. Sometimes, quite often actually, antibiotics are used in surgery, in a lot of major surgery, to reduce the likelihood of infection. And if they don't work because the bacteria in you has grown a resistance to them, it's not your fault.
Terrifying.
It is.
Terrifying.
And it's something that, the Dr. Neil Murray of Redx Pharma has said that we're all going to die of a nasty infection if nothing changes, which is a rather horrible thought.
Not me. Anyway, listen. Okay, so we know that some of the large pharmaceutical companies are perhaps not spending as much on antibiotic research as they should be. Mm. But there are some smaller companies that are.
Yeah.
And if this levy were to go ahead, They're gonna clean up here.
Yeah, $1.3 billion is what has been suggested as a reward for finding a new antibiotic. And Motif Bio, which is an AIM listed stock, we tipped it as a buy quite recently. They've got an antibiotic which is in the very late stages of development. They're thinking that that it could be launched within the next year or so. And a nice payout of $1.3 billion would would do them quite well. It is their sole purpose as a company is just at the moment is working on this antibiotic, this one antibiotic.
And Redix Pharma as well, you say.
And Redix Pharma, yeah, also has a few. They've got a couple of antibiotic candidates actually, and also an IC-BiTip, and they also work in oncology and immunology as well. But yeah, they've got a few antibiotics, and yeah, they'd benefit from a nice. A nice reward if their antibiotics were approved.
Yeah, but it does seem there is an opportunity there for someone to exploit. I mean, regardless of whether this 1.3 billion windfall comes their way, there is an opportunity there for someone to exploit.
Yeah, definitely.
I say exploit sounds like a terrible word. It's not really. I mean, there is an opportunity there for someone to do the human race an enormous favour and also make some money in the process.
Yeah.
That is one of the best quotes I've read in the IC in a while. We're all going to die of a nasty infection.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite horrible, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit bleak.
I think I'll just stay at home and...
Not take any antibiotics.
Not take any risks, not take any antibiotics, live in some kind of bubble. Yes, all right. God, dear. There you go. Anyway, thank you, Megan. That's quite a terrifying day.
Yeah, but rather morbid topic.
Okay, right. Good week for Serco.
Yeah, there were some good movements in terms of their contracts, things that are going to go better than they thought they would have. So, yeah, Serco's been in need of some good news. And we've had them on a kind of recovery, speculative recovery buy tip for a little bit. But, yeah, they seem to be doing it a bit better. So they kind of bumped up guidance on their 2016 financial year revenue. But I think the things that have come good are quite specific to this year. So I would caution against feeling especially optimistic about future years. They're not a widespread turnaround, but if you follow these stocks, you do realise they kind of bounce around when it comes to announcements on these contracts, given the size of the contracts.
Yeah, big old contracts a lot of the time. Absolutely. Let's have a quick flick through the results section. I think one thing we talked about before we came in here was the amount of companies using Brexit now as an excuse for slightly poor performance.
Yeah, there were a few this week that mentioned Brexit uncertainty. I'm not quite as cynical about it as you. I think there are industries where people are holding off business decisions.
Being you're not as cynical as me about anything. I'm just a cynic.
You are a cynic. But no, I think in the property market, there's places where people have held off kind of rental decisions or companies around movements, and that's something you can understand, kind of makes sense that they might press pause on kind of a big decision. And that seems to be limiting sentiment in the property market. But whether or not this sell-off that we've seen in property companies has gone over the top, I mean, some people, I'm sure, in terms of investors, are looking at now as a time to buy, especially if they think UK are going to vote to stay within the EU, which is what the betting odds say, and also slightly what the polls say currently.
Well, I think that's probably true. So we had a property trust presenting our event the other day, UK Commercial Property, which is part of Standard Life Group. And their view is that... The returns from property are not going to be quite as spectacular in terms of capital returns in the year ahead, but they are steady income generators. And, there is demand for commercial property.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, if you look at Helical Bar, not only are they trading at a kind of quarter discount to forecast NAV, which is huge.
I think Jonas described it as absurdly cheap.
But not only that, they're kind of trading at a discount to their... historic NAV, what their property assets were actually worth at the end of March.
Yeah.
So if you believe in that share price, you think that those value of those assets are going to go down. That's what the market thinks. Far be it for me to say that's wrong. But if you look at the kind of income that they're getting and how they're lifting their gross rents, and if you look at the demand that we know is there in the rental market, it's hard to see how that asset value is not going to be realised. So you wonder whether if the UK does vote to remain in the EU, clearly there'll be some kind of bounce back in some of the property shares, as we wrote about in the feature last week, in terms of the ones that have been kind of short sold the most.
I mean,
but still, you kind of wonder whether this is a value opportunity. But you are making a bit of a political judgment.
Well, listen, I'm kind of, as I've mentioned before, I'm not strongly one way or the other on the referendum, but the odds of Remain do look stronger to me. I think both sides of the debate have made a complete balls of it. I think they're both talking absolute nonsense, but I think in this situation, people are likely to opt for the status quo.
Yeah.
And, whether that's right or wrong, I'm not going to say. I'm not going to pass judgment on that. But I do think it means that sentiment towards particular sectors, property in particular, has been overdone. It's too negative.
But I suppose if you make that decision, you are taking some political risk in your investment decision, and yeah, you have to judge whether you are a pundit, and the polls can be wrong.
Okay, but let's say that you decided to go for this, you know, actually we think we're likely to remain, property's been oversold, I'm going to, you know, pile into these massive discounts in commercial property trusts and real estate investment trusts, and we vote to leave. So you're probably going to lose a bit more money. But ultimately, what I also believe quite strongly is that it will soon become apparent that were we to be independent, I don't think the Armageddon that people predicted is very likely either. And people would suddenly realise it's business as usual and property prices would bounce back, or property share prices would bounce back too. So I think it's a kind of one-way bet.
Land, they're not making any more of it.
Well, indeed. I mean, and certainly things like retail sheds. You know, you can't easily build a new retail park these days because you can't get planning permission for it. And that, you know, and that's kind of what these assets are.
Another company that talked about Brexit was Mighty Group. And Mark Robinson, who covers the stock, said that he didn't think it really needed to have bothered. Management didn't need to have bothered using the kind of Brexit shtick, as he called it. He thought these were pretty solid a set of results. But management did say that because of the EU referendum, that there were some decisions by clients to kind of delay or cancel projects as a result. So it's a difficult one because, you know, how much do you take the management at their word? It's a convenient ready-made excuse if you're a manager to say that. So it's probably a convenient ready-made excuse if you don't want to continue a contract to cite Brexit from the other side for the client
as well.
So you have to kind of make a call in those sectors that you think it's a justified excuse. But if you kind of try and put that to the side, Mark felt it was, you know, pretty strong set of results given.
Okay. I mean, you know, listen, I accept that Brexit, the referendum, let's not call it Brexit because that's not what it is. Let's call it the referendum. You know, it has had an effect on investment decisions. And we know, you know, as I've mentioned on this podcast before, in the world of advertising, it's been quite tough. People have put advertising decisions on hold. Advertising expenditure has been held back. And that's affected all the newspapers. That, you know, you can see it. You can see the numbers. ITV have had this problem as well. And that was reported in the magazine a few weeks back. You know, so it's definitely happening.
Yeah, sitting in this building, we can't really say
It's definitely happening. I don't think it's an excuse in the sense that, you know, it's not real. I think it's an excuse that the companies who would otherwise have been placing that advertising are using because they didn't really want to advertise in the first place because growth is not there to be had. Yeah. That's my concern.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's nothing to do with Brexit. It's just brought it into focus.
And it's just quite hard to tell whether that's the case from the end, you know, once you talk to the companies, because we're not there in the conversations that they're having, you know. It's quite hard to judge that. But I suppose what you have to do is try and think about how long you think that might go on, which way you think it might go. But I think that's why the feature last week was helpful,
you know,
allowing people to at least just consider it, or maybe it's just sit on your hands and wait and see what happens.
Yeah. And what we certainly do know is that growth is hard to come by wherever you are, regardless of whether there's a referendum or not.
Exactly right.
Okay, I mean, let's talk about some other results. We've got Megan. Let's see what you've got in the results section this week. You've had an interesting...
I had a bit of range this week.
Ranging week. Let's talk about Medicx to start with, which I'm interested in because I think this is a really interesting property story again. And again, this highlights the strength of property as an investment. And in this case, it's very specifically about healthcare property.
Medicx or Medix or however you say it,
we don't know how to say any of the companies we cover.
They own properties which are used for the NHS. They use for GPs, and all their 90% of their rent comes from the government via the NHS, which gives them a pretty nice revenue stream. But yeah, what I found interesting about doing these results was they're actually thinking that they're going to benefit from the NHS struggling. And you'd think that because they receive a lot of revenue from the NHS, it would not be so good for them. But because the NHS are struggling, they're having to merge a lot of their primary care facilities. There's been a lot of talk about GPs and physios and pharmacies all coming under one roof. And for that, we're going to need more buildings.
They're kind of like mini hospitals almost, really.
Yeah, it's exactly it. It's to reduce the pressure on A&E, which has been, and ambulances, which are always in the news about how much they're struggling. And actually, the NHS came out with their full year figures, I think it was last week. They were just
overspend. Oh, it's billions, wasn't it? So 2.5 billion or something overspend.
Yeah,
it was massive.
It was huge.
So you know, these are purpose-built primary care facilities that will house GPs and other things that would usually perhaps in the past have gone to the hospital to do X-rays, that kind of thing. And it's a kind of annuitized revenue stream which underpins like very healthy dividends for these companies.
Yeah. And there's a big longer term policy direction to enhance primary care, especially in an aging population, because they can't be dealing with having everyone go to hospital. Mm. But a lot of those kind of policies have struggled to make that happen. So it will be interesting to see whether, you know, this kind of enhancement of primary care through the kind of structures that this company are providing take, you know, get the kind of attention and get the kind of people in them that they need.
Yeah.
I think it looks fascinating, Medicx, and you know, it's something I would certainly consider for my portfolio. It's both an income play and a growth play, because I think, you know, the two things kind of feed into one another. You've got Primary Health Properties is the other one in this space, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's another property one, which it says it in the name, Primary Health Care Facilities. And I think Jonas is particularly bullish on that one. He really likes that that stock. There are a lot of revenue from the NHS, and it's a solid revenue stream. They're not going to stop getting money from
absolutely. So let's move from Medicx to Mediclinic, because I know nothing about this, because this is a South African business that we haven't really seen much of before, that's essentially reversed into a company that was listed on the stock market that it bought.
Exactly, a South African healthcare operator. They own a lot of hospitals and primary healthcare facilities in South Africa, also in Switzerland. Actually, the majority of their revenue comes from their Swiss business. And they have been inching towards the London market for quite a while. They bought a big share of Spire, which is the UK hospital company. Also, it's also listed, and they bought a large share in that last June. And then they were involved in a bit of a battle over the acquisition of Al Noor, which is a London-listed, but it's a Dubai-based healthcare operator, and they own lots of hospitals in the Middle East. And Mediclinic and NPS, which is also London-listed, Middle Eastern healthcare company, they were in a bit of a acquisition battle over buying Al Noor, but Mediclinic won, and they reversed into it, which gave them the London listing that they wanted, and seems to be doing pretty well. The results are not that easy to understand, because there's not a lot of comparison there, because it's their first real year as a much, much larger company. But they seem to be doing fine. We've also speculated that they're going to continue to look for acquisitions. That's actually the reason for our Spire tip, because Harriet speculated that Mediclinic might look to acquire Spire, because it's on the acquisition hunt at the moment. Mm. It's an interesting company.
Yeah, one to keep an eye on them.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, Bradley's not here, as we mentioned earlier, but he's been really busy this week, hasn't he? And he's... it's a shame he's not here, because he's covered at least half a dozen companies here. But particularly interesting, Thomas Cook, which has been having a horrible time.
Yeah, no one wants to fly to Turkey anymore.
That is an ugly share price.
People are cancelling their Turkish holidays and flying to the Canary Islands instead. I think it's kind of struggling to keep up, but it's been switching routes and doing its best.
But not as quickly as it perhaps could have. Then there's another one that I'd never heard of before. Well, I had heard of it, but I didn't really look at it. On the Beach.
On the Beach, not the Neil Young album, one of my favourites.
Showing your age, Ian. I think it's one of my dad's favourites.
Showing my wannabe age. Have you not seen them advertising on the Tube? Our online travel agent?
I don't get the Tube.
Well, there you go. They advertise people that are on the Tube and hate being on the Tube and want to go on holiday.
I hate being on the Tube, so I don't get on the Tube. I don't have to. I've got legs.
So, yeah, they're an online travel agent. And they also have been dealing with the fact that people don't really want to travel to places that have been subject to terrorism or kind of geopolitical instability in general. So kind of Turkey and also the Northern Africa, the beaches of Northern Africa.
But they never really had the exposure to that in the way that Thomas Cook did in the first place.
Exactly right. So they are doing quite well because of that. Even with this reduction in consumer consumer confidence, which I suppose Mike's take starts to take after the year end. These results only run to March, but their revenue grew more than a fifth, and it's one of those recent floats that seems to be doing okay, but they always seem to be doing okay until they collapse terribly.
Well, is it a normal travel agent, or is it targeting a particular demographic? Is it upmarket? Is it? I mean, I don't know. I don't get the tube. You've seen the advertising.
I've seen the advertising, but I've never actually used it. Yeah, I think it's just kind of online travel agent that it looks like it kind of just targets, I don't know, yuppies on the way to work. I know absolutely nothing about it. I know it's. Sorry, that's terrible, isn't it?
No, because they don't exist anymore.
I know more about the Neil Young album. There's a great song at the end, Ambulance Blues. So there you go.
Okay, fine. Well, it ties neatly in with our healthcare discussion. I mean, another company that I've always enjoyed reading about, writing about, but no longer eating, unfortunately, is Cranswick. I mean, this is a tremendous company. It's a meat processor.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to eat meat, and I stopped. And when I ate meat, I tipped this, and those shares have just kept flying. I mean, it's an amazing business.
And another business that has grown well through acquisition as well. So it's been trying to diversify into the kind of chicken, kind of UK poultry market. So it bought Benson Park in 2014. And after this, the end of this period, which was end of March, it bought Crown Chicken. So it's kind of growing its revenue streams all the time. So it's diversified, but not diversified so much that vegetarians like yourself, John, would be heading down there. But yeah, it's just a well-managed company that's managed consistent growth. Yeah,
I mean, from what I understand about Cranswick as well, in the past, the British market was serviced by Denmark largely for its bacon, and Cranswick seems to have been involved in a reversal of that. And you know, part of what, as I understand it, part of what they have done is there are much higher standards of animal husbandry there. Maybe that plays into the antibiotic thing as well. Who knows?
There's also been in the kind of market scandals over meat, hasn't there? You know, in terms of mince meat and the kind of things that have crept in there, the whole horse meat scandal. So you can understand why there might be a domestic bias now from buyers to buy UK or to know where it's coming from.
Yeah, it's tremendous business.
But they've invested well to up their capacity at the points where demand has risen. So, you know, they're doing exactly what you really want a food producer to do. And they're also buying other businesses that are doing the same. So,
yeah, absolutely. Okay, I mean, there are so many results in the magazine this week. We could go on all day. We've got Shaftesbury, which is continuing to do well. London Property. We've got
Delarue. Interesting. First year of a 5-year plan. Have a look at that. They've kind of had an uptick in investor sentiment.
I mean, that's been a horrible business for a long time.
And operating in a market you'd expect is exactly the wrong one to be in, which is printing banknotes.
Plastic notes is doing that. They seem popular, don't they?
But the plastic notes and the security side of the business is doing well, and they seem to be emphasising the right parts. We've had Paris with the whole buy-to-let peak. Their pipeline is down as, you know, the increase in stamp duty is stopping people taking out buy-to-let mortgages, but they're diversifying into banking and asset finance. So that's quite an interesting one.
And we've got first results from New Bank, Old Bank, but newly listed bank, CYBG, Clydesdale and Yorkshire, I think that is.
Yeah, Clydesdale and Yorkshire Banking Brands under CYBG. That's doing well. Costs are still high. It had a period of underinvestment under its kind of former owners, the National Australia Banking Group. They're going well. They're still a discount to the wider market, and that's because they just don't have a decent return on equity. They need to grow their loan book.
But it just needs to get bigger.
They need to get bigger. Yeah, it's not the most complicated game in that respect.
No.
It's a difficult time to grow a profitable business.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, like I said, too many results to even talk through in brief mentions. Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Ian. It's really interesting. I said loads of good coverage this week. Loads of really important themes I think we've managed to cover in the magazine too. The cover feature this week, which is why I haven't discussed it, is our annual top 50 ETF survey, which is put together by the personal finance team, and they will undoubtedly be discussing this on their podcast, which is recorded tomorrow. The reason we do this is because a lot of investors who want to really get the benefit of investing but without the hassle and the headaches and the risk and the fear and the price of investing through, you know, equities is to use ETFs to build portfolios based on asset allocation strategies. And here we give 50 across a broad range of segments. We've got the next update in the 50 object series from Philip Ryland, which is a good read. Lots more. Jonas Crossan has looked at Sadiq Khan's potential rent cap, which he's proposing for London, and I think Jonas's view that it ain't going to happen. Lots more in the comment section. Chris Dillo, Simon Thompson, updating his bargain shares portfolio, stocks green sector focus, as we usually have.
Taking stock is a wonderful
read. How could
I
forget
this
taking
week?
Stock in? Taking stock on telecoms regulation. You've got to read that. It is a good column, Ian. It is a good column.
Yeah. I'll wait for all my letters to come in.
Yeah. Listen, Algie Hall gave a presentation at the event on Tuesday about accounts receivables in context of Rolls-Royce's ongoing Total Care contracts. And he got laughs. So, you know, you never know, Ian. You never know. Anyway, lots in the magazine, lots of news, lots of comment, lots of results, lots of coverage. It's a massive issue this week, over 80 odd pages. Hopefully be a bit smaller next week. I won't be around. I'm off to on my holes, but I'm no doubt Ian will be. Well, I won't be on the beach. I don't do beaches, cities. So, yeah. I won't be here next week. I'm off my holes, but I'm sure that I leave you in good hands with Ian and the rest of the team. In the meantime, go pick up the magazine. Top 50 ETFs available in all good news agents. £4.70. Thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.